inició el mecanismo y le pide al presidente de la Generalitat que explique si declaró la independencia.
Es la respuesta que el señor Puigdemont dé a este requerimiento la que marcará el futuro de los acontecimientos en los próximos días. En su mano está volver a la legalidad y restablecer la normalidad institucional o prolongar un periodo de inestabilidad, tensiones y quiebra de la convivencia en Cataluña.
La pelota vuelve al tejado de la Generalitat y lo que ha dejado claro Rajoy es que el diálogo que quiere Puigdemont no es posible, ni siquiera con mediadores.
No es posible aceptar, bajo la apariencia de un diálogo equívoco, la imposición unilateral de puntos de vista que se saben imposibles de aceptar por una de las partes.
Rajoy acepta reformar la Constitución, pero por los cauces normativos que permite la Carta Magna. Nada nuevo. La respuesta no ha sido suficiente para ninguna de las fuerzas políticas. Su principal aliado le pide al presidente que aplique ya el 155, disuelva el Parlamento y convoque elecciones autonómicas.
Yo no le tengo miedo a tomar decisiones políticas, no le tengo miedo a llegar a acuerdos con quien piensa distinto. Y el futuro de Cataluña pasa por ser generosos, por llegar a acuerdos y volver a restituir la democracia en Cataluña. Pero eso no se hará si no pasamos tarde o temprano por las urnas.
El PSOE insiste en una reforma constitucional.
Es imprescindible precisamente porque esta Constitución que tenemos ha demostrado que es el verdadero marco de convivencia. Un marco de convivencia en el que caben todos, sí, señores de la Generalitat de Cataluña, cabemos todos.
Y desde Unidos Podemos han llegado las principales críticas a Rajoy.
Le pido que se ponga al frente de una negociación y no detrás de la policía y de la ley. Deje de actuar como jefe del Partido Popular y actúe como presidente del Gobierno. Deje de romper España.
Lo que no hablemos ahora no desaparecerá silenciosamente en la noche. Por tanto, diálogo, diálogo, diálogo. Y si no pueden dialogar, márchense.
Hay que ser audaces y valientes. Nuestro país, insisto, es plurinacional y esos cambios hay que hacerlos no desde arriba, sino contando con la gente, de forma participativa.
Sin duda, diálogo y reforma constitucional son los dos conceptos que más se han oído por parte de la oposición en esta sesión, pero el presidente del Gobierno, Mariano Rajoy, no ha movido ni una coma de su guión establecido y le da de plazo al Gobierno catalán hasta el próximo 19 de octubre para que rectifique si hubiera declarado la independencia. Rafa González, Hispan TV. Madrid.
En Brasil se realizó una movilización frente al Supremo Tribunal Federal para pedirle que anule el golpe parlamentario contra la presidenta legítima Dilma Rousseff. Casi 100.000 firmas fueron entregadas a la máxima corte, pero planean reunir 1.300.000, suma que representa el 1% del electorado brasileño. Esto para reivindicar la anulación de la votación en el Congreso que avaló el impeachment y con ello la destitución de la presidenta. Adriana Robleño reporta.
Durante toda la tarde aquí en Brasilia se reunieron aquí en la capital representantes del partido de la causa operaria para marchar luego hasta el Supremo Tribunal Federal y exigirles que fuera anulado el impeachment, el golpe contra la presidenta Dilma Rousseff. Ellos argumentan que si ese golpe, que fue un golpe ilegal, porque nunca se demostró que la presidenta Dilma Rousseff hubiera cometido crimen de responsabilidad. Si ese impeachment es anulado, o sea, porque legalmente existen condiciones para eso, también serían anulados todas las reformas, todas las medidas de tipo neoliberal que ha tomado el gobierno de Michel Temer. Ellos argumentan también que el gobierno actual no los representa. Está representando a un proyecto que es el proyecto de la derecha, que fue el proyecto electoral que perdió en los comicios donde fue electa legítimamente con 54 millones de votos la presidenta Dilma Rousseff. Si bien ellos dicen que no hay muchas esperanzas de que eso prospere, que ellos no se hacen ilusiones, sí saben que esa es la única forma de restablecer la democracia en Brasil, el hecho de que sea anulado el impeachment contra la presidenta Dilma Rousseff. Les propongo escuchar lo que nos decía una de las manifestantes.
Si conseguimos anular el impeachment, que es una lucha bastante difícil, nosotros no nos hacemos ninguna ilusión con eso. Impondríamos una derrota a todo el programa que se está poniendo en práctica y que ha continuado posteriormente sin duda alguna.
A pesar de ser bombardeada por esa narrativa equivocada de los medios, 72% de los nordestinos quieren a Dilma de vuelta y 59% de los brasileños quieren a Dilma de vuelta. Ahora digo yo, y si los medios no fueran golpistas y la justicia no fuera parcial, ¿cómo es que en nuestro país desgraciadamente no 99% querían a Dilma de vuelta porque ella fue electa, y mantenerla en el poder es respetar el voto popular, respetar la soberanía del voto, es respetar la democracia.
La soberanía del voto es respetar la democracia.
Bueno, pues estas eran las opiniones de, como decía, algunos de los participantes y de los organizadores de esta manifestación, esta marcha que, como decía, llegó hasta las afueras del Supremo Tribunal Federal, la máxima corte del país. También el día de hoy se conoció que el Tribunal de Cuentas de la Unión bloqueó los bienes de la presidenta Dilma Rousseff. Estos bienes fueron bloqueados por el supuesto hecho de que hubo prejuicios por la compra de una refinería en Pasadena, Estados Unidos, cuando la presidenta Dilma Rousseff formaba parte del Consejo Administrativo de Petrobras. Por este hecho, les han bloqueado los bienes a la expresidenta Dilma Rousseff, y según los manifestantes nos decían, casi cuando se acababa ya esta manifestación, esto forma parte de la persecución contra los líderes de la izquierda aquí en Brasil. Es el caso de Dilma, también es el caso de Lula, que vemos cómo la persecución judicial contra el exmandatario también se profundiza. En el día de ayer, la policía fue hasta la casa de uno de los hijos de Lula para hacer búsquedas porque recibieron una llamada donde supuestamente había drogas en la casa del hijo del expresidente. Vemos entonces cómo continúa, decía, la persecución contra estos líderes de la izquierda aquí en Brasil, y el pueblo brasileño, veíamos cómo hoy estaba en las calles exigiendo la anulación del impeachment, del golpe, para evitar que se profundice más la situación de excepción que está viviendo hoy Brasil.
En Argentina, miles de trabajadores de astilleros y sus familias advierten que la industria nacional se encuentra en peligro por las acciones del gobierno del presidente Mauricio Macri. El informe nos llega desde la emisora comunitaria Radio Futura.
Se volvió a conformar la Comisión de Familiares en el astillero Río Santiago. La medida evoca a la famosa comisión conformada en la década de los 90, que tuvo un papel protagónico en la lucha contra el intento de privatización. El astillero está ubicado en la ciudad de Ensenada, que forma parte de lo que se conoce como el Gran La Plata, en la provincia de Buenos Aires. Es uno de los astilleros más importantes de Latinoamérica en la construcción y reparación de buques, tal es así que actualmente están terminando la fabricación de dos buques petroleros para Venezuela, uno de los cuales será entregado este verano. Escuchamos a Martín Esquerra, delegado en soldadura del astillero Río Santiago.
Se conformó la Comisión de Familiares para apoyar la lucha que venimos llevando adelante los trabajadores, y bueno, al igual que en los 90, donde también tuve familiares que fueron parte de la comisión, bueno, de esta Comisión de Familiares, y familiares que fuimos llevando a los trabajadores, que por ahí no van a las reuniones de la comisión, pero que participaron del acto, hubo vecinos, amigos, hubo un acompañamiento importante de parte de la comunidad de Ensenada, La Plata y Berisso, que nos fortalece, porque la verdad que en esto de que se están comprando buques en el extranjero y que se nos está cortando la continuidad laboral en el astillero, lo que vemos es que la pelea va para largo, y es bueno sentir el apoyo de la comunidad, ¿no?
La comisión resurgió como iniciativa de los propios familiares con el objetivo de apoyar los reclamos de los trabajadores. En el astillero trabajan 3.500 obreros, pero actualmente hay secciones que están paradas, por lo que peligran muchos puestos de trabajo.
Hay dos pedidos. Uno que es al gobierno nacional, sería, que es que no se compren más buques en el extranjero, porque este gobierno se endeudó por 400 millones de euros para traer buques del extranjero. Trajeron buques militares en desuso de Israel, ahora trajeron para el INIDEP, para el Instituto de Pesca, trajeron otro de España. Entonces el punto es que si se siguen comprando buques afuera y no se construyen en la Argentina, que encima se podrían hacer mucho más barato, nosotros estamos como sin razón de ser, digamos, en el astillero. Y el otro reclamo es que el gobierno provincial firme los avales, digamos, las garantías, las cartas de crédito que tiene que largar el Banco Provincia para que se pueda poner en funcionamiento el contrato que ya está firmado por dos buques graneleros grandes y dos remolcadores que tenemos firmado con la empresa nacional Bahía del Mar.
Los trabajadores evalúan cómo darle continuidad al plan de lucha para que los reclamos sean atendidos por el gobierno nacional y provincial de Cambiemos. Reportó para Farco, Radio Futura, desde la ciudad de La Plata.
aquí concluye esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Agradecemos la colaboración de RTN, de Telesur, del colectivo Más Voces, de Radio de Naciones Unidas, del Informativo Farco, de Hispan TV, de Venezolana de Televisión y del diario La Jornada. A nombre de Toshkli y de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
And up next on Free Radio 101.3 FM, freakradio.org, it's Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. Today is Thursday, October 12th. That's Indigenous Slaughter Day, or Columbus Day to those who love the conquistadors. So stay tuned. I know your actual, I guess the holiday was on last Monday, but I'm trying to be calendrically correct. So stay tuned.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So it is another Indigenous Slaughter Day, as I call what some folks in the U.S. call Columbus Day. And usually every year around this time, I read from Lies My Teacher Told Me, a book by a man named Lowen. And it's got a really elaborate and interesting and detailed description of the mass murder that Columbus and his brother and his successors on the island of Hispaniola in a relatively short period of time engaged in, working Indians to death. And it's just really a brutal story. And in the light of the recent call to have Columbus statue removed in San Jose, and actually it has been either removed or there's pressure to remove it in other cities, and it's been, I think, defaced and vandalized in other places, I've actually quoted James Lowen in articles where mainstream newspapers like the San Jose Mercury News has been covering pressure to remove the Columbus statue from the city hall. In fact, I think there's almost, it's either there's an agreement to do it or it is, I think they're looking for another location, but it's now a serious issue. 17 years ago, when activist James Costner, or Just Man Jim, as they used to call him, who was a local Native American activist and a student at the UCSC and an activist against the sleeping ban in Santa Cruz, attacked the Columbus statue with a sledgehammer, unfortunately without any video or witnesses, and then he's been spending the rest of his life paying for it. He was convicted and jailed, and he's now actually in pretty good shape. He's teaching up north, but he was kind of ahead of his time in that regard. I didn't much appreciate what he did then, because he dragged me and others, it felt like, into a lengthy defense of his, and without any kind of discussion. He didn't force us to do it, but I think I felt obligated. And Jim is an old time, as I call him Jim, he prefers James, is a long time and old time supporter of folks defending against police abuses in Santa Cruz, poor people on the streets who are getting harassed for the crime of visible poverty. That's their crime. The actual specifics are sleeping or covering up with blankets or sitting next to a building or being in a park after hours and so forth and so on. Anyway, there's another story I ran across recently, and I'm going to read it. It covers a critical view of Columbus. I suppose, to be fair, I should read more of the positive side of Christopher Columbus. But as I've said, or rather written in defending people who want to remove Columbus's statue, and those who oppose it, saying, oh, he was a great Italian-American, and it's, you know, it's really horrible how Italian-Americans have been treated in history, and particularly in America. They were held in wretched conditions in internment camps during World War II here. That's never talked about, though the Japanese-American shame and disgrace here in California is widely known. And my response has been, yeah, now let's pick some real heroes. Not a mass murderer like Columbus, but people who actually fought oppression as Italian Americans. That would be a worthy, if you're going to get kind of nationalistic about it or you want to look at your Italian roots, that would be a good thing to do. So lest the real innocent, if not heroic, can't say about that, Italian Americans be forgotten, here's what Wikipedia has to say about the internment of Italian Americans. This refers to the government's internment of Italian nationals in the United States during World War II. 1941 to 1943 was when the U.S. was at war with Italy. Similar to that of the internment of Japanese Americans and the internment of German Americans. As was customary after Italy and the U.S. were at war, they were classified as enemy aliens, and some were detained by the Department of Justice under the Alien and Sedition Act. It's an infamous act from the late 18th century. But in practice, the U.S. applied detention only to Italian nationals, not to U.S. citizens or long-term U.S. residents. Italian immigrants have been allowed to gain citizenship through the naturalization process during the years before the war. And by 1940, there were millions of U.S. citizens who had been born in Italy. Ethnic Italians were the largest group in the United States among nationals and ethnic descendants of the three peoples represented by the three Axis powers, Germany, Italy, and Japan. In 1942, there were 695,000 Italian immigrants in the United States. Since 1881, some 1,881 were taken into custody and detained under wartime restrictions. These were applied most often by the War Relocation Authority to diplomats, businessmen, and Italian nationals who were students in the U.S., especially to exclude them from sensitive coastal areas. In addition, merchant seamen trapped in U.S. ports by the outbreak of war were detained. Italian labor leaders lobbied for recognition as loyal and not enemy aliens. Those Italian Americans who had initiated naturalization before the war broke out, they objected to blanket classification of Italian nationals as subversives. And in 2001, the U.S. Attorney General reported to Congress on a review of treatment by the Department of Justice of Italian Americans during World War II. And in 2010, the California legislature passed a resolution apologizing for U.S. mistreatment of Italian residents during the war. And a couple more things before moving on. In September 1939, that was in the outbreak of war between Britain, France, and Germany, and then later Italy. U.S. didn't come in until 1941. In September 1939, Britain and France declared war against Nazi Germany after Adolf Hitler invaded Poland. In a show of support for Britain and France, President Franklin D. Roosevelt authorized J. Edgar Hoover, for the FBI, to compile a custodian detention index of those to be arrested in case of national emergency. The Axis powers allied with Germany included fascist Italy, the Japanese Empire. More than a year before the attack on Pearl Harbor, the Department of Justice began to list possible saboteurs and enemy agents among the German, Japanese, and Italian populations. In 1940, resident aliens were required to register under the Smith Act. Chronology of events. On December 11th, Nazi Germany and Fascist Italy declared war on the United States. That's December 11th, 1941. The United States reciprocated and entered World War II. Beginning on the very night of December 7th, the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, and before the U.S. officially declared war against Italy, the FBI arrested a handful of Italians. By December 10th, 1941, nearly all the Italians, about 147 men, that FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover planned on arresting before the official declaration were in custody. By June 1942, the FBI had arrested a total of 1,521 Italian aliens. About 250 individuals were interned for up to 2 years in the WRA military camps in Montana, Oklahoma, Tennessee, and Texas, in some cases co-located with interned Japanese Americans. The government targeted Italian journalists, language teachers, and men active in an Italian's veterans group. And there's a lot more in this Wikipedia article. Of course, these facts in terms of the oppression of the Italian Americans here in the U.S., though wrong and disgraceful, and in the case of the innocent Italian Americans, simply racist, based on their Italian language and their Italian background rather than any indication of subversive behavior, it still it pales in comparison with what happened when Columbus arrived in Hispaniola in 1492. That's modern-day Dominican Republic and Haiti. Let's go into this article by Joel Helfrich. Christopher Columbus is no hero. What are the following cities and towns, Burbank in Los Angeles, California, Colorado Springs, Colorado, Oak Park, Illinois, Davenport, Iowa, Portland, Maine, Tulsa, Oklahoma, Farmington, New Mexico, Ithaca, New York, Charlottesville, Virginia, and Edmonds, Washington all have in common? They have all, within the last month, that is September, replaced Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day. In so doing, these municipalities have joined the cities of Denver, Phoenix, St. Paul, Minneapolis, and Seattle, the states of Alaska, South Dakota, and Vermont, and various countries in South America that have taken a dramatic first step towards foregrounding the history of indigenous peoples in the Americas. Perhaps it is time for other cities, towns, states, counties, businesses, colleges, universities, and school districts throughout the United States to do the same. Christopher Columbus is not a hero worthy of a national holiday, nor any parades. He is not a hero by 15th century standards, nor 21st century standards. Columbus was incompetent and immoral. A self-promoting opportunist, he set out to find people to conquer and convert to his own religious dogma. In fact, he misinterpreted and created his own version of Christianity. He was truly a supporter of colonialism and all that goes along with it. Rape, murder, enslavement, warfare, violence, control, conquest, and, yes, genocide. Born in Genoa, Italy, Columbus had at least two goals: converting indigenous peoples in the Americas and raising enough money to help reconquer Jerusalem for religious zealots. Columbus ran an effective public relations campaign. No one knows exactly how or when Columbus came up with the idea of sailing west to find a trade route to Asia. At the time, he was a petty trader and mapmaker in Portugal. He married an aristocratic wife in Portugal, helping him gain status and respect in the eyes of other nobles. He was persistent, having spent years lobbying in the royal courts of Portugal and Spain. The Portuguese had already found a trade route to Asia around the southern tip of Africa and were not interested in Columbus's plans. Spain, on the other hand, was busy trying to expel all Muslims out of the country. After 8 years of lobbying and after the Muslims were defeated, King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella agreed finally to fund Columbus's expedition in 1492. Columbus presented maps based upon the calculations of the ancient Greek philosopher Ptolemy, Marco Polo, the European who had visited Asia hundreds of years earlier, and his interpretation of the Christian Bible. Columbus secured numerous concessions from the Spanish rulers, including the right to govern and rule over whatever territories he discovered, and a percentage, 10%, of all profits received as a result of the voyage. He convinced Spain to support him, although most of his geographic theories were unusual. Most educated Europeans knew that the world was round. although no one expected there to be large continents blocking a western passage to Asia. Educated Europeans believed the world was about 24,000 miles in circumference, meaning 10,000 miles separated Europe's west coast from Asia's east coast, too far to sail in the small ships of that time. Columbus, using his understanding of the Bible and other ancient sources, argued instead the world was much smaller and that Asia was only 3,000 miles away, not 10,000. In fact, his misunderstanding of geography motivated his voyage. Although he was a foreigner with limited experience in sailing or navigation, he convinced the Spanish to support him. He won support even though the Spanish advisors to Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand recommended otherwise. During his voyages, he promised a large sum of money, about the equivalent of $1,500 today, to the crew member who spotted the Asian landmass first. While he initially credited this sighting to Juan Rodrigo Bermejo, Columbus later rescinded this offer, claiming instead he had seen land a few hours earlier. Indeed, Columbus knew how important this would be in terms of fame and fortune. Columbus also recognized the power of names. He immediately called the indigenous people of the area Indians in an attempt to reinforce his assumption that he had landed in Asia. He renamed islands after Spanish monarchs or Christian holy days to win favor and support. He also renamed himself Christopher, meaning Christ-bearer. After his first voyage, Columbus emphasized the most potentially profitable aspects of the islands. He pointed out that the indigenous peoples were easily conquered and enslaved to work for and bring wealth to the Spanish government. He also argued that they deserved this treatment because they lacked civilization, no clothes, wheels, or weapons, and because they were pagans, enslavement might lead to Christianization. He exaggerated the amount of gold and silver he found while in the Americas, a few pieces of jewelry. He claimed to have found useful plants and products in the New World, misidentifying some and exaggerating the abundance of others. He prepared and published a written report of his voyages soon after his return. He had received a hero's welcome in Spain, and capitalized on this fame and goodwill. Europeans read his accounts, and other explorers sailed west. Columbus displayed captured Indian peoples before the king and queen, and brought back samples of plants and spices he found there to enhance his fame. On his return trips, he brought larger numbers of Spanish colonizers with him. Columbus could not control them. They mistreated Indians and conflicts erupted. Some Spanish returned to Spain and criticized Columbus. They reported to the king and queen negatively. As a result, Columbus failed to win the allegiance or support of Indian populations. In fact, he periodically kidnapped Indians to display before Spanish authorities and to work as slaves under the encomienda system he implemented. He was responsible for bringing the first enslaved peoples across the Atlantic. When Indians fought back, he responded ferociously with attack dogs and swords, killing unarmed indigenous people with impunity. He bragged about his behavior. The Taino and Arawak people were decimated by his actions, warfare, and enslavement, not just the diseases that Columbus and his men brought to the Americas. Prisoners were often hanged and burned to death. As noted war historian Samuel Elliott Morrison pointed out in 1955, the cruel policy initiated by Columbus and pursued by his successors resulted in complete genocide. Columbus enslaved hundreds of Indians, which upset Spanish authorities who had hoped to peacefully Christianize the Indians. Spanish authorities also viewed the Indians as subjects over whom Columbus had no rights. Columbus failed to maintain regular contact with the king and queen. He spent much time in the Americas attempting to stabilize his colonies and even refused to return to Spain when summoned. Contemporary observers, especially some priests, criticized Columbus for his mistreatment of Indians. The king and queen, based on unchallenged negative reports about him, stripped Columbus of his governing authority, and he was brought back to Spain in chains. Columbus died on May 20, 1506, at the age of 55, never realizing that he found a new continent rather than a shorter route to Asia. In fact, when other Europeans critiqued his view, Columbus clung to his thinking. He still had money, but had lost his royal titles and much of his prestige. If there are traits and abilities for which we should remember Columbus, they are his skills in public relations and his support of a militant church. His life informs us a great deal about the troubling history of contact, conquest, and slavery. He had introduced Europe to a source of riches that ultimately made it possible for Europe to surpass the Middle East in terms of wealth and political power. Gold, slaves, minerals, agricultural products, and other goods from the Americas that helped finance European industrialization and further colonization of the Americas, Africa, and Asia. To the people who still support Columbus Day, they should keep in mind that Columbus spent most of his life outside of Italy and never touched land that would become U.S. soil. He traveled to Hispaniola, Haiti and the Dominican Republic, and other Caribbean islands, especially Cuba and present-day Venezuela. Furthermore, Columbus's faults were many. He was a poor geographer, a cruel and incompetent administrator, and held misguided goals and religious views. If we choose to overlook behavior, there are likely better candidates to honor, men such as Ferdinand Magellan, who went around the world, for example. Or at least his ships did. Columbus's life and actions are representative of the tremendous and horrific violence and enslavement brought about by the nation state. If we were to interrogate that history, much of which is still getting played out in the present in the United States, perhaps it is time to foreground the history of indigenous peoples in the Americas over Christopher Columbus as a key first step. Indeed, adopting Indigenous Peoples Day for every city, school district, county, and state is a no-brainer and truly low-hanging fruit. Making such a statement would not only give hope to Native Americans, but also set a higher bar for our national heroes and holidays. And the man who wrote that was Joel Helfrich, who teaches history, or so this says, at Monroe Community College in Rochester, New York, holds a Ph.D. in history from the University of Minnesota. And now for a sort of a contemporary break, come back up to the present. Although I guess we are in the present, even though it's looking back into the past. Here's a little satire from the Randy Rainbow song parody called You're Making Things Up Again, Donald. While I'm not really a big fan of jumping on the Democratic Party bandwagon of simply focusing on anti-Trump antics, or the antics of Trump as a simply a way of diverting attention from the policies that both Republicans and Democrats both follow and that are driving this country into, despair, although I guess we continue anyway. But we're talking about foreign wars, we're talking about mass incarceration, we're talking about, if you look at Santa Cruz, how homeless people are treated. Don't think I can find many right-wing Republicans on the city council, but they're all pretty much, though some of them are speaking out quietly against it and occasionally voting against it, you have a long history of oppression that isn't about to change without real action from the community. Anyway, here's a little satire to perhaps lift the spirits.
Here's the bottom line. We've got to keep our country safe. You look at what's happening. You look at what's happening in Germany. You look at what's happening last night in Sweden. Sweden! Who would believe this? Sweden! They took
it. Hey, Siri.
I have no f***ing idea.
They took in large numbers. They're having problems like they never thought possible. You look at what...
He just told a lie. Nothing happened last night in Sweden.
Folks, we were left a mess like you wouldn't believe. That mess that I was left by Obama.
You're making things up again, Donald. You're stretching the truth again, and you know it. Don't be like Kelly and Donald, because a lie is a lie. You're making things up again, Donald. You're eating the facts and then shitting up fiction. Please just stop doing that, Donald.
Or we're all gonna die.
Mr. President, go ahead. Regarding your tiny little baby temper tantrums about the press, or as you call it, fake news, aren't you concerned, sir, that you are undermining the First Amendment?
The public doesn't believe you people anymore. Now, maybe I had something to do with that. I don't know. But they don't believe you. If you were straight and told it like it is, I would be your biggest booster. I would be your biggest fan in the world.
And if I may, what is your response to the headlines claiming that Your White House is in total chaos.
There's zero chaos. We are running. This is a fine-tuned machine. I won. I mean, it's story after story after story.
You're rambling endlessly, Donald. You sound like my drunk Aunt Suzanne at Thanksgiving. You can't just say what you want, Donald.
You're talking straight out of your hole.
You're making things up again, psycho. You're scaring the shit out of most of the country. With all due respect to you, psycho, I don't think real presidents get their briefings from Fox and Friends, right?
No.
And we're back with my guest, President Donald Trump. Oh, it's so hard to say that. Donald, what about all the accusations continuing to swirl around you and Vladimir Putin? And when are you just going to put the rumors to rest and tell us? Are you guys engaged?
We'll see what happens.
Well, he is very handsome. He's also a cold-blooded killer.
A lot of killers. We got a lot of killers. Why, you think our country's so innocent? Does anybody really think that Hillary Clinton would be tougher on Russia than Donald Trump? Does anybody in this room really believe that?
I do.
You're making things up again, Donald. Making shit up. Eating the facts and then shitting up. Making shit up. Please just stop doing that, Donald. Or you're gonna get us all killed.
Who would believe a deranged hypocrite? Who would believe I'd be wishing for Mitt? They've jumped rationale and Sean Spicer needs Valium. Is anybody buying this shit?
No.
Again,
I own nothing in Russia.
Again,
the news is fake. We had a very smooth rollout of the travel ban.
You're making things up again, Donald.
Nobody mentions that Hillary received the questions to the debates.
Sweetie, get over it.
No good.
Lots of punch. I don't agree with everything that Randy Rainbow has to say, but he punches it out well. Anyway, you're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org, as you probably know, but perhaps you don't. Quick look at the newspapers here. Week ago, here's a story in the Mercury News, smoking ban on state-run beaches, not this year. And for years, state lawmakers have been trying to eliminate secondhand smoke and cigarette butts from California's 280 illustrious beaches and natural parks. Once again, they have come up short. Late Friday, it was a week ago, Governor Jerry Brown vetoed two bills that would have banned or drastically curtailed smoking and vaping in parks and beaches run by the state. If people can't smoke even on a deserted beach, where can they? Brown pondered in his veto message. There must be some limit to the coercive power of government. The proposed bill would have banned smoking at state parks to protect people from health hazards associated with secondhand smoke, which some people deny, and prevent the risks that cigarette butts pose to marine life. And the author of one of these bills, Assemblyman Mark Levine, Democrat of Marin County, said he was disappointed. The common dangers, he said, know these dangers too well. Common person knows these dangers too well. And flippantly dismissing them isn't cool. I don't know if raising the argument that it is kind of outrageous and draconian to give police the authority to ticket people for hundreds of dollars for smoking on a deserted beach. Maybe for littering. You know, I mean, that would deal with the cigarette butt situation. But simply for smoking when no one else is around. I mean, that's what they do in Santa Cruz. In Santa Cruz, of course, it's illegal to smoke in any park, including the huge Poganip, Pina Gulch, and Moores Creek areas, allegedly because it's a health hazard. In distant areas where there's nobody else there but you, it's not a health hazard. It might be a health hazard to you, but that should be your business, not the nanny state's business. It's important. It gives the police the power to run you around with laws that, for example, impact, well, at least several years ago, they impacted 70% of the homeless people Nationally, I don't know about locally, because I suppose it could be different locally, but nationally, studies have found that homeless people smoke at essentially three or four times the rate of folks who are housed, or the general population, including the homeless. So it's a real attack on homeless folks, and it's, for homeless people, it's a form, I think, of medication. Not a smoker myself, don't like people around me who smoke, but to ban it everywhere and give the police the power to give poor people absurd numbers of tickets for doing something, and that is one of the three, that was one of the three main causes of citations and stay away orders in the parks areas in 2014 and 2015, according to research that I and other members of HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, found as we researched the issue. One of the bills vetoed, at least had it passed, it would have, though banning smoking altogether on state beaches, it would have established smoking zones at state parks. Said the smoking ban passed by the legislature was too broad and too punitive. Even the previous governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, also banned, stopped this from going through, or vetoed it, including Los Angeles, Long Beach, Santa Cruz, San Diego, and most communities along the South Bay Coast, according to this story, already have ordinances banning smoking in parks and public beaches. And four, Huntington Beach was one of the first cities to ban smoking, the story continues, on the sand at city beaches. Huntington Beach recently expanded its ban into beach parking lots. This past decade has seen a major push against smoking in public, including bans at city parks, most college campuses, and the Orange County Fair. Laguna Beach recently became the first in the county to ban smoking in the entire city. Clemente last year introduced an ordinance that outlaws smoking at beach entrances. For me, it's simply an unwarranted expansion of police power here in Santa Cruz, as mentioned before, that particularly impacts poor people. The power of police, religious authorities, and conservative forces generally in California is still pretty strong. Here's a story again from, this is from the Mercury News of a couple of days ago, actually yesterday, Wednesday the 11th. Medical marijuana dispensary decision put on hold. And this is in the city of Livermore, which is sort of in the general Bay Area. Earlier this year, 58% of more than 1,100 Livermore residents taking an online poll said they would support a well-regulated medical cannabis dispensary in town, and 35.8%, a much smaller number, opposed it. But the Livermore City Council may become the only city in the Tri-Valley, I'm not quite sure what other cities are in the Tri-Valley, but to allow a medical marijuana dispensary, but right now they aren't. So Livermore continues to ban a medical marijuana dispensary in its area. This is decades after Santa Cruz, San Francisco, Oakland, and other cities have opened dispensaries under Proposition 215. But not Livermore. The city council agreed Monday night it's not yet ready to decide whether to allow a shop dispensing medical cannabis in town. Council members said they didn't want to act before the state has adopted dispensary operating standards and before the city holds more conversations with East Livermore residents. Upset, the city is looking at sites they think are too close to homes and parks. Again, this paranoid fantasy, or this simple cover for anti-marijuana prejudice and reefer madness, which says that somehow if you have a shop near a school where people can go in and buy marijuana, that is likely to corrupt the youth, or it's going to create a crime problem. Discredited myths that are still being, and this is what really kind of annoys me, propagated as worthy of news coverage. You don't have people covering revisionist views of the Holocaust in the mainstream media, though some people do believe that and state that. I guess we had people on the city council who were actually explicitly saying stuff like that, like they're pushing out myths about the homeless and myths around marijuana, that somehow here in Santa Cruz, as folks may know from recent broadcasts, city council is going to limit recreational marijuana places to 5, I believe. Or actually, it's 2 or 3. Right now, it's holding medical marijuana dispensaries to 2. And it, for years, it didn't allow any in terms of its very restrictive location accessibility areas where people could open up a business of that kind. Are the same standards applied to 7-Elevens selling liquor and tobacco, far more toxic substances? I'm really, I know you may be getting as tired as I am of mentioning this argument. No, but instead you have this endless attack on marijuana. Now, I'm not a big marijuana user. I puffed every now and then. But the idea, really, it pisses me off that this kind of just sort of dumbass ignorance, but really toxic and full ignorance, is running rampant and is being mainstreamed, of course, by agencies like the police department and other law enforcement agencies. Not all, I'm not saying all of them do, but it's, I think you're far more likely to find that kind of attitude there than elsewhere. And the Livermore authorities are also voted 5-0 to direct the staff to prepare an ordinance that would ban shops selling pot for medicinal or recreational purposes. So they're planning to ban it. They, you know, they're concerned that it's going to depress property values, tempt the youth into smoking. After 58% favor well-regulated medical marijuana dispensary, and only 35% oppose it. That's a story from the October 11th Mercury News. And now another laugh break at the expense of the Republican buffoon who's in the White House, but the Democratic buffoon and war criminal who preceded him, I really have to say, offered fundamentally the same policies for international war, for pandering to insurance companies, nor ignoring basic housing priorities, clear arms race, as Trump. Trump has, you know, put him on steroids, but there's been no fundamental change, and you don't hear the policies being attacked. But this is an old song for me, but let's put a little snickering into it.
I'm back. I'm joined now by an old friend, Donald Trump, the president. Still? Okay. You've had a rough week for about a year now. Why don't we start with some of the most recent natural disasters?
Hurricanes.
Actually, I was talking about your breath and your hair.
We started with Texas. And Louisiana. Don't forget, Louisiana got hit hard. And I went to Texas, and I went to Louisiana, and met the people, and I think it helped. And we got very high marks. We got A pluses.
Good boy!
And then the following week, Puerto Rico got hit. And if you remember, it went in and out, 3 times.
Wow. Well, let's not get into your sex life just yet. Let's first talk about all the negative press you received when you returned from your trip to Puerto Rico.
I will say this, it's fake news. There's nothing else you can say about it. One example, they had these beautiful soft towels, very good towels. And I came in and there was a crowd of a lot of people and they were screaming and they were loving everything. And I was having fun. They were having fun. They said, throw them to me, Mr. President. And so I'm doing
this. Screwing it up since the election. Completely devoid of introspection, yeah. You're more abnormal than your pumpkin-like complexion. Oh, you are as artificial as your own toupee. You're offensive in every way. Think you're pretty special, but you're just a phony. Puerto Rico, Charlottesville, and Kimmy Dong. Can't keep track of all the times that you've been wrong. And will our country still be here at the end of your 4 years? Baby, I don't know if you'll last that long. How can we have chosen such a mental case? Every day you devastate the human race. America's at luck so long and sayonara. Bye bye. I mean no disrespect, but you're a big disgrace. And what is all the orange stuff that's on your face? Maybe you should finally just admit you are a desperado. Upsetting everyone you meet, though. Stop reprimanding Puerto Rico. Throwing paper products at the people. Desperado. Getting worse with every stupid tweet, though. Why you always talking like you're from the street, yo? Go to your account and please just hit delete, though.
Right.
Oh, for the color of the sign outside the store that says Home Depot. You're a proudy, braggadocious cripple. When you're in over your head, so you go.
Get that son of a bitch off the field.
Every time you open up your mouth, it's extra staff to bleep, oh. You even hate on freaking Meryl Streep, oh. And for the reason that they cannot sleep, oh.
It's fake news.
You're so hopped up on your megalomania. I feel bad for Melania. The truth is right in front of you. Stop smoking marijuana. The words that come out of your mouth make you sound like a dum-dum. Just stop saying words that make you sound like you're a dum-dum. On foreign matters, you're an inefficient novice. Get out, get out, get up, please get out of the Oval Office. It turns out your morality is lower than your jowls. Not to mention,
Here, have some paper towels.
We are also praying for the people of Puerto Rico. We love Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico.
We love you.
And we also love Puerto Rico.
Desperado. Always caught up in a web of deceit. Always pretending like you're not a lito. Always look like you're about to trick or treat. Desperado. Your hair's a mess, your face is always beat, though. Why you picking on the poor athlete? Why you acting like you're on a TV show?
Hey!
Oh! For the color of the sign outside the store that says Home Depot. You're a crabby, unproductive creepo. Enter it over your head to people.
Get that son of a bitch off the field.
Every time you give a fucking speech, the center's half the bleepo. Your spray tan looks so muy cheapo. And you're the reason that we cannot sleep, oh.
It's fake news.
Desperado. Getting worse with every single stupid tweet-o. Don't know why your hands are so petito. You're upsetting everyone you meet, though. Desperado.
Very good towels.
And all that personal invective was from Randy Rainbow, which he looks like he has a weekly YouTube. And to catch the real punch of this, you got to go to the YouTube channel, look up Randy Rainbow. And he's got some great visuals that follow along with the songs and the commentary, and you get to see the Fuhrer there as well. He interposes his own commentary with that of Trump and Trump's gang. So check it out. Here's a short bit from poet Julia Vinograd, who I had on at greater length. It was either last show or the show before, from her new book, Detours. Probably can find it either online. You can buy it directly from her. She could use the money. Or you can, although she doesn't, she's very paleo. She doesn't really go online, but I can give you her address and you can send her $5 and get her book. I think you can even find some of her stuff in the library now. And I've got some of her stuff too. If you're interested in the Street Spirit newspaper, they often reprint her poetry, which you can now find the new October edition of. That's the homeless newspaper that homeless folks sell. And you can sell too if you're poor or nearly homeless or want to be a part of that distribution network. Get some at the Sub Rosa Cafe if you can find the place open. It's up at 703 Pacific, right next to the bike church. That's where Huff will have its next meeting, currently slated for November 1st, unless there's a massive call for an earlier meeting. I kind of have taken pride in Huff's meeting every week, but it's really not convenient for the other people who do want to come. Some have to come from as far away as the Monterey area. Some even as far away as Salinas. I guess they're both equally distant, but it's a ways to come. We do meet at the Sub Rosa at 11 o'clock every Wednesday, as I've mentioned before. But if you have interesting material, reports, questions, you can reach me by phone on the Huff line at 831-423-4833 or 423-HUFF, 423-HUFF. Getting back to Julia Vinograd, up in Berkeley, I ran into her and she gave me a couple of poems that she wrote even after her latest book, which just came out, was published. And I'm going to play a bit of that now.
At the Chow Down with Julia Vinograd here in Berkeley. It's October 9th. We have a couple of folks looking on. Patrons of the poet, Gloria, and of course, our latest guest,
Lisa,
of course. Julia, you got a new book out. We've already actually previewed your book, Detours, a couple weeks ago. But you've got some poetry that isn't in your book that you're going to be reading.
Let's see.
Whipping it out of the file there or whatever, manila folder. Go ahead, what you got?
Both topical. This is called Freedom. We sing freedom songs, but can freedom sing us? What does freedom see through our eyes? What music opens us to freedom, skin and bones and sweat and dream, and a tin whistle sharp as scissors to cut our puppet strings? Does freedom want us as much as we want freedom? Does freedom have a shadow? Or are all of us from every time and place only freedom's shadow? Does freedom taste like clear water from a well in the forest with spongy moss and curled ferns so cool on our tongues? Can freedom blow us along the whirling stars like a big wind and all the better because we don't belong there? Is freedom as wide as the ocean or will it light like a ladybug on a single fingertip? Does freedom play marbles with whooping little boys in the street? Does freedom sing a counting song for a little girl in Mary Jane shoes jumping rope? But when freedom sings, numbers spread wings and the little girl laughs. Is freedom the smell of fresh baked bread cooling on a windowsill before the shop is open? Does freedom that never dies walk through our graveyards asking, why did you leave me? Do the memorial stones answer freedom, or the occasional marble angel, or the roses? Freedom leaves no footprints on the grass as she asks again, why did you leave me?
And that, of course, is freedom.
Yes. Julia, now I see why I'm so upset that I lost all your books.
Oh.
Maybe they'll turn up.
No, they're gone.
I think they have them in the library in case you... But Julia's got, really inexpensive...
20, 30, 50, 100?
There's more than 60 of them.
Yeah, more than 50. And I started with, I think, volume 15 or something, whatever it was.
Yeah, that's perfectly possible. I'll read one more, okay?
Yeah, sure. We can read two more if you want.
It's called Long Time Lost. I went to a Halloween store and stroked the costumes. Spangles, feathers, oops.
Strawberry shake.
Rudely interrupted. We will continue. Go ahead.
Okay, long time lost. I went to a Halloween store and stroked the costumes. Spangles, feathers, day glow, painted skeletons. I tried on the masks. I was looking for myself. I've been lost a long time. Mirrors glare at me and stick out their shiny tongues. The pillow on my bed is stuffed with fingerprints enough for a city, maybe mine, maybe not. I'm lost. A long time. There was a mask of the Statue of Liberty, green rubber spikes. I wonder if the Statue of Liberty could wear a mask of me. There was a giant rooster mask that crowed if you pulled a string. I've always wanted to crow, but I don't have a string. There was a wild Indian mask that came with a belt of fake scalps, but I worried if one of the scalps was mine. I'm lost. A long time. I didn't find myself at the Halloween store, but I could tell. I wasn't the only one looking. So many lost. A long time.
Name of that poem is?
Long Time Lost.
All right. And you only brought two poems, so I think that's all we're going to get today.
Yeah.
Thank you, Julia.
Well, they're the best of the new ones. I have others, but I think those are the best.
Yeah, Lisa.
I thought it was stupendous.
Recently, I was up in the Berkeley, Oakland area. In fact, on this trip where I picked up this interview with Julia Vinograd, and had a relatively long interview with some folks at a homeless encampment on the border of Oakland and Berkeley, which previously described itself as the group First They Came for the Homeless, but it's since changed a bit. And I'm going to be going into that shortly. But first, here's a story from the Chronicle about camps a little deeper into the Oakland area. It's by Otis R. Taylor, Jr., who looks like an African-American correspondent for the San Francisco, or columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. You'll find him in the second section, the Bay Area section. A few weeks ago, Mayor Libby Schaaf put on an Oakland A's hat, an outlandish T-shirt with a stylized oak tree, jeans, and sneakers to serve salami sandwiches to people living in the homeless tent community underneath Interstate 880 near 7th Street, one of about 100 bedraggled encampments in Oakland. Went out with City Team Oakland, a faith-based nonprofit that operates a soup kitchen. It serves roughly 8,000 meals per month. City Team also runs an emergency shelter and regularly passes out blankets, food, and toiletries at homeless camps. Twice a week around dinner time, City Team takes sandwiches to tent encampments. Mike Murray, City Team's rescue mission manager, said Schaaf seemed moved talking to the people she met. He recalled Schaaf spending 20 minutes listening to a homeless woman's concerns about hygiene. "I wish more people who work for the city would do that to kind of get a feeling for what it's really like instead of what they hear at town hall meetings," Murray told me. "I think it would open their eyes more instead of hearing people complain about it. There's a lot to complain about, but there's also a lot that can be done. Well, Oakland is about to try something again." On Tuesday, the Oakland City Council voted unanimously to carve out plots for safe haven, quote-unquote, sites. At the sites, residents will camp in secure, fenced-in areas where they have access to health, drug addiction, and employment resources. Of course, often such claims are camouflage for, let's get these bums and scums out of our neighborhood, but we got to look compassionate, so we'll give a little, so you can just call this number and you can get a resource, and there'll be resources for you. And the real issue, of course, is whether there are real resources. And often people in these circumstances are desperate enough to believe those who are supposedly going to be the recipients of those resources to take these claims seriously. So, for instance, at yesterday's HUF meeting of Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, where we had some reports from Lapis Road, that's the RV dwellers area down in the Seaside Marina area, there was, from even seasoned activists, Becky Johnson and Wes White were initially talking about how the county has promised that there will be a safe parking area for at least some of the RVs who've signed up for the social services. But when I question more closely about just which of these resources were actually going to be available on a very specific time schedule, it became clear that it was very vague and that these were promises rather than actual. There were some things that had been done. There was some bids have been put out. They might have found a location, although the ground wasn't very good. In fact, what I think I may be doing is to kind of get the update from activist Wes White when I'm finished with this article. He gave it to us yesterday at the HUF meeting, but I don't think it's really good enough audio to play. But the real issue of whether resources are actually available or whether this is camouflage It's become such a familiar song and dance by municipalities, counties, that it's always has to be looked in very, very closely. And I don't know of any city that's providing for homeless people in a fully and successfully. It just isn't. It hasn't been done. They don't have the political punch. The other interest groups are too powerful. And the real issue is not to help them, but to hide them or drive them away. Continuing with this article, more important, the sites will be used to funnel people into temporary housing. Again, another famous little excuse and story that we get along the way. The idea was inspired by the Compassionate Communities Program as an experimental city-sanctioned camp with portable toilets, hand-washing stations, and trash service under Interstate 580 near 35th and Peralta Streets. That camp, guided by Councilwoman Lynette Gibson McElhenney, was eventually scrapped after two fires and complaints by neighbors. Here are the proposed locations for the new camps, and there's a series of locations which I'm not going to go into because they're up in Oakland, but there are only three of them. And again, this camp under Interstate 580 near 35th, I believe it was one I visited with some other activists to try to talk to folks and make connections, and they were very hostile to us because I think maybe they had their fill of media people. Don't know. I'm relatively low key media, though I have my trusty little audio recorder, but activist Wes White had his video camera, tripod, cameraman, and so forth. And in any case, supposedly, of course, the area was they abandoned support for it because of two fires and complaints by neighbors. Well, it's the same kind of reaction to this that when I hear complaints by neighbors and two fires. If you were living in a on a block of houses, and there was a couple fires there, and other neighbors complained. But that's kind of that vague justification will be the basis for cutting off garbage collection, cutting off sewage, cutting off water and toilet services. I don't think so. I think, but we've been conditioned to believe that somehow that these folks who live outside, they're subhumans, and they have to be kind of put into a special category. We don't really care about them as much, or at least they have to be understandable that they aren't, they're more kind of, they're like the natives, you know, they haven't learned to be civilized. They have to be shown how to write checks again, you know, they're drug addicts and they're alcoholics, and unlike the drug addicts and alcoholics who live in houses and are better off. I think you catch my drift. Each site will serve 40 people at a time, and there will be 24-hour security, controlled access, only residents will be allowed to enter, and on-site management. The new plan also includes tough sheds, storage units that look like backyard playhouses. Comment here, is any of this being chosen by the homeless people who live there? 24-hour security, controlled access, and on-site management. Usually what that means is it's not being done really for the benefit of the people there, although I suppose insofar as you have a paternalistic government offering, and it could be construed that way. But this was the complaint and concern of activists like Linda the Lark Edwards, an early Santa Cruz activist I met in 1988 and who worked hard on fighting for the rights of homeless people in Santa Cruz against the sleeping ban and to establish places to camp and sleep before she died of cancer in 1995. Her concern about the established sites patrolled 24-hour security was that they became, in essence, in her words, quite candidly, concentration camps. If they aren't really run by the people who are the recipients of the services, then they're being run by people who have a different agenda, really. And the agenda, compassionate as churches may want to be, for instance, their agenda is different than that of folks who come together to establish intentional communities, even transient intentional communities. And you're going to hear some people talking about these are the descendants of first that came for the homeless encampment, which I did an interview with, which you'll be hearing shortly. Also, the sheds, the tough sheds, are similar to the dog houses, as I described the Poverello House tool sheds in Fresno that activist Mike Rhodes wrote, boil in the summer and freeze in the winter and don't have adequate facilities and are sort of a poverty pimpery, low-budget excuse for giving the police the power to drive homeless people out of sight, because they always keep a couple of these sheds open for, hey, you can come to a shed, that's your resource. Oh, you're not accepting a resource, we'll arrest you. And that's, or just move along, get out of here, and we won't arrest you. Just keep moving. And that's what this article brings to my mind. It could be I'm a little too negative about it. Don't know. Residents, according to the article, will be able to stay in the city-sanctioned camps in Oakland for up to 6 months. According to a report prepared by the city administrator's office, the annual operating cost to the city will be about $472,000. There's an added one-time cost of $78,000 for the tough sheds, fencing, office space, and storage facilities. The city's latest budget appropriated $450,000 per year for 2 years for the program. I suspect the budget of Oakland is in the billions. This is a drop in the bucket. The new plan looks great, but I see one glaring problem. The homeless crisis in Oakland affects thousands. It would provide relief, he understands, to only a fraction of the people on Oakland streets and sidewalks. The homeless population in Oakland jumped by 25% to 2,761 between 2015 and 2017, according to a recent point-in-time count. The city's solution helps 120 people, as I mentioned before. What about everyone else? We're not pretending this is a permanent solution or a complete solution, Schaaf told me. That's the mayor. I hope I have her name right. But we have to start somewhere, and this is what we can do immediately. People who drive past encampments daily see the piles of garbage and the stockpiles of furniture, clothes, and whatever else can be collected. But it's a different experience when you walk through the camps and talk to people. And that's what I told a guy I've come to know over the years who I visit, who's a local a musician in his 20s who lives in the Oakland-Berkeley area, but whose view of homeless encampments is very negative, even though he's never been to one, or never been in one, or never walked through one, or talked to people in one. He criticizes and excoriates his, I guess, perhaps fellow musician or a friend who talks about throwing cyanide into the spraying cyanide in the encampments to get rid of the people there. But he does dismiss them all as crack addicts. Although if you talk to him more closely, he'll acknowledge that's not the case, but he quickly moves on to different subjects. It's not a matter of interest to him. And it makes one realize just how deeply this toxic kind of they're a bunch of rats mythology that Hitler used so successfully with the Jews in Germany can spread to any oppressed group that is, and then of course driven off into areas where their conditions look more and more wretched, more and more ghetto-like. And it'll be blamed on them, of course, not on those who have driven them into it, or the housing conditions that have created it, or the medical costs that have made people homeless, or the massive war expenditures that have denied the kind of resources that a society needs to be spending on basic things like housing and health. Mayor says, this is not a permanent solution or a complete solution, but we have to start somewhere, and this is what we can do immediately. And actually, there's a hell of a lot more they could do immediately, but that's all they're offering to do immediately. And everybody's supposed to be grateful and run around with their tongues lapping down saying, thank you so much, thank you so much. People who drive past encampments daily, I think I've read this before, but let's jump ahead. That's where you'll learn, if you actually go out there to talk to people, that the narrative of homeless people being lazy drug addicts doesn't fit everyone who lives in a tent. Many homeless people have jobs. They just don't make enough to afford a roof over their heads. There are as many circumstances as people in those camps, Schaeff said. To paint broad strokes or make sweeping assumptions on every single one of these thousands of unsheltered residents who call Oakland home is misguided and unhelpful, because if you want to solve a problem, you have to understand the problem. Yeah, I mean, I guess there's nothing really new here for anybody listening to this. Murray, who visits homeless camps daily, said the new camps might be the right step to solving the homelessness problem if there's follow-through with these people to get them into permanent housing. It's not to get them into permanent housing, it's to have permanent housing. It doesn't exist as the real estate speculators vie for more and more profit as Trumpism of the Democrats and Republicans reigns supreme. That way, the public will become more accepting of the situation if they see there's a positive outcome afterward, Murray said. As long as there's follow-through, the public could actually get behind it. In other words, get these homeless out of sight, please. Affordable housing, yeah, sure. Let's not cut into whatever our privileges and prerogatives are. And that's the story Oakland tries to save, Oakland to try safe haven homeless camps by Otis R. Taylor, Jr. in his On the East Bay column.
Welcome back. We are joined now by America's UN Ambassador, Nikki Haley. Ambassador, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Many of us are perplexed, to say the least, by President Trump's recent UN address, particularly the ominous threats he made to, quote, totally destroy North Korea. What the hell was that?
Well, I think what you saw yesterday from the president was he was being honest.
Maybe that's why we didn't recognize it.
I know that, you know, people and countries don't want to hear it, but here is a man who continues to threaten our allies. He says he's going to destroy the United States to ashes.
Yeah, but enough about Donald Trump. Let's talk about North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, who the president has been taunting recently, both on and off social media, with the nickname Rocket Man. Do you really think that's a good idea?
I will tell you that, look, this is a way of, like, you know, getting people to talk about him, but every other internet...
He always takes to Twitter just to grumble, grouse, and gripe. He's having fun, but Kim Jong-un is not the playful type. I'm slightly more than panicked that this schmuck is gonna wipe us off the map by acting like a baby. He's playing cat and mouse, but he's the mouse among these men. He fires up his fan base with his talks at the UN. I'd rather he behave more presidential, but again, he's acting like a tiny little baby. And though I know his followers are thrilled, he's gonna get us killed. How do you solve a problem like Korea? How do you sleep when missiles start to fly? How do you not have constant diarrhea when all of our lives depend upon this guy? Many a name you know you'd like to call her, but certain things are better left unsaid. 'Cause how can you do the trick with childish rhetoric? How can two tiny men have such big heads? Ooh, how do you solve a problem like Korea when you're a crazy dotard?
Dotard.
Dotard. Or a dotard, I'm sorry.
Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself. The United States is ready, willing, and able, but hopefully, Rocket Man.
Gonna be a long time. The touchdown finally brings him back to life. He's not the man they think he is at home. Oh no, no, no. He's a rocket man. Rocket man.
Jong-un saying he takes President Trump's threats personally, so he has been rattled.
I think it's gonna be a long, long time. So this dude finally does something right. You think his tiny brain would finally grow. Oh, no, no, no.
Dotard.
Dotard.
He's a rocket man. Rocket man. Gonna start a world war with his phone.
They will be met with fire and fury,
the likes of which this world has never
seen before.
Oh, Jesus.
How do you solve a problem like Korea? How do you get them not to drop a bomb? How do you calm their autocratic leader?
Just tell him his hair looks dumb and go, your mom. Trust me, that shit always works.
Why does your mouth have constant diarrhea when you're supposed to be a diplomat?
Your imbecilic insult could have apocalyptic results. Just tweet him and say, hey, Kim, your ass is fat. Don't.
Oh, how do you solve a problem like Korea?
And by the way, Rocket Man should have been handled a long time ago. Little Rocket Man.
Girl.
Not like that.
Rocket Man.
Dotard.
You, so I can hear what you have to say. So I'm out. First I came for the homeless. Is that the right way to call this encampment?
Well, actually, we're not claiming first they came for the homeless right now. We're actually just the here and there camp. We have a here there sign out front, so we use that name.
How long have you been here there and not first they came for the homeless?
Well, we're... Go ahead.
Well, we're talking with...
Robin House.
And with...
Jay DeMello.
Thanks.
And so, about a month ago... a few weeks ago to like a month ago, there was someone who started this, and the people who were originally here actually left. So now we're just going by here, their camp, because new community members came in who were no longer associated with.
What was the name of the guy who started it who left?
Mike Zent. Yeah, Mike Zent.
And did they go to another place? Did they go indoors?
Mike Zent got housing. He got some low-income housing. That's basically what we're all fighting for, is for low-income.
His health was in pretty bad shape, as I remember.
Tiny homes and stuff like that. And
he was in pretty bad shape physically, as I remember.
Yeah, he still is. Yeah, he's got to watch what he eats. So we go over his house once in a while. I've been there just once, but other people here go over there and talk with him. And
is it a permanent situation, or...?
I'm not sure how long it is. Also, another guy, Mike Lee, he was a big guy in this camp and did a lot of communication with the public, and he also got housing. But he's still a big part of the camp. He's still doing the protests and all that stuff for homeless and low-income housing.
Have there been protests recently in Berkeley, Oakland, the Bay Area around this issue?
I haven't really seen any, like, signed protests or anything like that, but I'm interested in doing some in the future, like doing an Occupy or, like, having people just sleep on sleeping bags on the street just for, like, a few days to show that, you know, we're out there and that, you know, this is a real problem, affordable housing, the fact that it's, you know, you can't get a one-bedroom apartment without spending upwards of $2,000, it's, like, ridiculous, you know, so.
How long have you been here?
About 5 or 6 months. Yeah.
This camp's been here for about 8 months now.
And you've been here for?
I've been here for about 4 months. About 4 months. And they took me in and they showed me the rules. We have rules here printed out on the sheet right up there.
Fundamentally, what? No drugs, respect the neighbors.
No drugs, no alcohol.
Marijuana accepted.
Marijuana is, yeah, we're lenient on marijuana.
Tobacco, the toxic evil tobacco. Yeah. He's smoking.
How can you tell? But yeah, there's rules. There was meetings every week. We kind of stopped the meetings because there's a lot of butting heads on ideas and stuff like that. So once the people that were semi-running this camp just left, the camp just kind of took a deep breath and just kind of reorganized and said, we're not really big protesting camp. We're not sticking our faces in the police's business. And, you know, we're just saying here, you know, we're going to stay here until we're kicked out. And apparently we're not going to get kicked out because we have community support. We have a lot of people that bring in donations of food and clothes and drinks and every day. The public seems happy with us because we're keeping it clean outside every morning. There's people coming up cleaning this whole camp.
Looks pretty clean. I mean, I see the occasional garbage bag.
Yeah,
but
the garbage have been taken out today.
But the garbage is in the bag.
Yeah.
That's what counts.
Well, actually, the bag is, we do plastic bottles and cans and stuff like that.
Recycling.
Yeah, we recycle.
Have recycling centers been closed down much around here?
I heard they closed one down, but I don't personally do the recycling. We have given it out to one of the guys that come here. He comes here once a week and takes our trash out with his truck. And we always have trash for him, and he does get a good load in his truck.
And again, we're talking with
Jay DeMello.
I want to make sure I'm...
Yeah.
So I understand there was a porta potty that was set up, but it was kind of far away, and then folks moved it closer, both to for the convenience of the people at the campground, but also for the convenience of the neighbors who were housed, who preferred it be moved. Is that accurate?
That's accurate, but what the original thought was for this camp was to get porta potties for our camp, and we fought and fought and fought, and finally they brought porta potties and they brought them across on the other side of the BART tracks, and that's where that camp is that are not affiliated with us, and they're very dirty and they're doing drugs, and the girl just died over there the other night from an overdose.
What was her name?
I don't know, but she was like 22, 23 years old, and so they're doing, you know, what we're not doing.
Did you move the porta potty closer? Or?
The porta potty, we still fought in city council meetings, which people go to every week or every 2 weeks, whenever they are. I personally don't go, so I don't know. But the porta potties were moved up to this side because we're the ones that tried to get it over here in the original.
Do you have any kind of relations with the folks at the other camp?
No.
Informally? Or?
No.
The listeners are right next to a BART track. Any thoughts about anything that the Jay has said?
Yeah, well, just with the other side of the camp, it's kind of like we've heard yelling and screaming and fighting over there before, and anytime that's going on, we go over there and make sure that everything's calm and if there's anything that we can do to de-escalate the situation.
Any connections with folks so you can communicate in some way, or...?
No, we don't have any set of communication or anything like that. We just kind of listen, and like if we hear anything going on over there, we might help out, but other than that, we don't. Like, some people over there come over here and get water that we have, or they look for some food, but other than that, you know, we don't really.
As of yet, you haven't been driven deaf or crazy by the BART train.
Yeah.
It's become kind of homey having the BART train go by.
It fades into the distance over time.
Very loud.
How large is the other camp, would you estimate?
Maybe like 15 people.
Yeah, they're growing. They are growing. They're accepting basically anybody, which we're trying to avoid. When somebody comes to our camp, we let them know that this is a protest camp, and we normally don't take just drop-ins like that because we're a group and we're trying to fight with the city right now to try to get, you know, housing. And there's people that work here and then jobs and stuff like that, and, you know, we do have a lot of rules. So when somebody walks up and says, I need a place. We do bring people in that situation. If they just come up to us and they seem level-headed, they say, I really need a place, I just got kicked out. Well, why don't you meet some of our people first, come back tomorrow and meet some of the people and kind of get an idea of what we're like, and if they still want to tent up with us, then they can do that. But we have a limit of like 25 people, and Miss Ritchie is a big person in this city. And she was the one that told us that she's been talking to the public and they don't want any more tents. So we got a limit. We're almost at our limit right now. But we took in a guy. He came up with scoliosis and Parkinson's disease, just shaking all over the place, and said, I need a house. I need a tent. And he said, you're right. You know, we don't question that. So we have people with mental illnesses here. We have people... three people in wheelchairs, and
how many women?
We had two women. They just left. We got one, two, three.
Yeah, we had six, but now there's only like three because Michelle left. She was part of the original group, and then Hannah recently left, and another girl actually went to the hospital. So.
And we're talking with
Robin.
I'll get that sooner or later. So,
Robin.
Robin. So, it's my impression as I drive through Oakland, under every freeway, you see more and more tents. Now, I haven't been following it, you know, really carefully and scientifically, but and I don't know how much you guys get around, but you probably know more than I do. Is homelessness expanding, outdoor visible homelessness expanding in Berkeley? Anybody want to answer that?
It is expanding, and all the city can come up with was, let's just get rid of them. They're plotting a piece of ground right now for us, which is more like a concentration camp. It's on 2nd Street. They have the money to build this, and it's for the homeless, and apparently they can only take in about 50 to start out with, because they're building like these warehouses. It's going to be like a shelter, and they have a fence around it. And I'll give you
a security guard.
Yeah, you have a security tower at the gate. The gate will close at night, and this is not what people want. And this
semi-automatic.
It's controlled by the government, and you know, this is a protest camp against the government. You know, because they're not supplying the needs for homeless people. You know, and that's what a lot of people support us about, because they know us. They know what we're about, and we get all these people coming in with donations of food, clothes, everything. And we got a lot of support. We got the money together for the bathrooms, for the porta-potties, which we bought. So those porta-potties are not put in this camp, because we're told that we need a permit for the property to put on this property.
Famous Mayor Jesse Arguin.
I'm not familiar with him.
He's the Führer of Berkeley. Well, he's the mayor of Berkeley.
Okay.
I don't know who makes the decision. Probably somebody, some bureaucrat in the planning department or something.
This is actually Bart's property right here. And they don't mind this as long as we stay off the fence close to Bart like this, and we're keeping it clean. They don't say nothing. They don't care. They had some management come through here the other day taking pictures. The police leave us alone because they don't want to get into another protest, I think, is one reason. And we're not having any issues from the public right now because we keep a really clean camp, and we try not to be loud. And, you know, we have shutdown hours, and it's really organized here. You know, we bump heads once in a while, and there's arguments, and there's, you know, fights, and, you know, the police has come here a couple times, and just the other night, the officer told me, he goes, don't hate us, don't hate us, and I shook his hand, and, you know, they did their deed, you know, they took out somebody that needed to be 5150, and, you know, that happens, but, you know, the people that we bring in, that's why we like to say, you know, come around and meet everybody first, and then we'll all kind of get an idea what this person's about, and if they're not acceptable in this camp, so, you know, I'm sorry, we're full.
In Santa Cruz, those who are, I call them anti-homeless or NIMBYs, are using a variety of so-called concerns, excuses. Hepatitis A is one that's being used because of the high incidence hepatitis A in San Diego and also in Santa Cruz County. Apparently it's gone up big time. Although they're trying to, for a time, some people were trying to shut down the Food Not Bombs meal by claiming they were spreading hepatitis A, but they had no evidence of that. So the chief health officer in Santa Cruz, whose name is Leff, said, no, you know, we're not going to do that. What's the story here? What about hepatitis A? What have you heard about that?
About that also.
Any friends of yours have hepatitis A?
No.
What about you?
No, but I do feel like it could potentially, or at least part of it, be linked to a lot of people picking up cigarettes off the ground and smoking them, just smoking on the butts, because a lot of people will smoke, and like hepatitis can be transferred through saliva, and then whenever people suck on the same cigarette on the ground, a lot of people.
But you don't know of anybody who actually has gotten it.
But I haven't. No, I have not met anybody
not
personally.
And not much. Is there much illness in here and there?
No, there's just a little cold going around, but that's it. Like I say, we are all off. Nobody's on heavy drugs here. It's not accepted in this camp. And I think people see that when they, you know, we're going to put up another sign about us, and we're going to put out some.
What are your signs currently, sir?
Our signs are not up right now, but basically it used to say.
It used to be a sign first they came for the homeless, and had a Jewish star on it, which I mean, none of us acclaim here to any religion, and we're hoping to break away from that. But because
the idea that the Jews were discriminated against, and so
yeah,
that was my understanding of what that was.
Totally, but we're a lot of people here are somewhat like anarcho-communists, and you know, moving towards the simplicity and minimalism, and like fighting the like large corporations and contributions to them. Because it's really hard to, you know, not contribute to that whenever you're living in modern society and have a job and, like, live the way that, you know, a lot of corporations set up the way that you can live. And it's all based on capitalism, on how, like, we have to have a job and we have to have worth and to have social, like, comfortability around people. Like, a lot of people are uncomfortable with, you know, not having money and not having a house, you know. But we believe, I mean, at least for me and a lot of people that, a lot of friends that I've talked to here, they're really, you know, anti-capitalist anarchists that want to see a better future for people where we don't have to enslave ourselves just to survive to get food and clothing and shelter, you know.
So. Is there much police action against homeless people generally in Berkeley?
I mean, I stayed on the street down on Shattuck for probably about a month and a half. And
what is that?
About like right before I got here, about 6 months ago, so 6-7 months ago, and it was actually the lack of doing anything. That's what I noticed, that the police are actually gone and they ignore a lot of it. And there's a lot of stuff that, you know, they do, like there's fights that happen and like and gangs that mob up on people, and it's the lack of action, you know. And I really felt like, you know, the service aspect of them, like they would see, you know, a homeless person freaking out and doing something, and they drive by and it's like, oh, I don't want to have to deal with another one of them, and you know, and they speed off, you know. And like, it's just, you know, at 2-3 a.m. there's people, you know, walking around. It's kind of like it was kind of like, remember whenever I played Nazi Zombies and I was like really scared, and it was just like people were just walking around really slow, like, oh, 3 a.m. and it's like cold, and you know, these people are on really hard drugs and they're just walking in circles because they got nothing else to do, you know. And it's people with clothes that are just completely battered and they just smell of, you know, shit. And it's just,
We have security here at night too. It's a volunteer security. It's not every night, but we try to have somebody up for the two shifts that are available. From 10 to 2 is one shift, and from 2 to 6 is another. For these stragglers that come into the tents and walk around, and they actually try to look inside the tents, and they take all the food, you know, as much as they can, that's donated to us. And these are the people that we tell them they got to leave. And we try to be nice to them, say, you know, are you hungry? Here's some food, here's a soda, and please leave. You're not, you know, this is a protest camp. This isn't a drop-in center. But, you know, if you need some help.
Down the street.
Yeah, drop-in centers down the street.
Do you direct people to the other camp?
Well, yeah. We do tell them there is another camp across the street.
Does it have a name, by the way?
No. But like I say, if somebody leaves here, and we got an extra tent, which just happened recently, two tents were available. A couple level-headed people came in and said, hey, you know, I just got kicked out. You know, I need some help. You got a tent? And yes, we do. So we'll bring in people like that up to our limit, which is 25 tents.
Have you had much communication with people in Oakland who are outside?
I am not a racist person, but I'll tell you, Oakland is bad news. I've seen the tents set up there, and it's just, there's crap on the streets, there's garbage everywhere. They need help, like everybody needs help, and they're just not at our level. And the people that do come by from that area seem to, the ones that made us aware of, you know, who's walking up the street late at night. They were problems for us. And, you know, I feel sorry for them because they're homeless like us, you know. And I think the camp that we're in has been called a model camp by the cops, by public, different people walking by. You guys are a model camp. And people see that, and I think the camp, like, behind us, are they want to be a part of us, so every once in a while they're claiming us. You know, we're with them, but we're trying to separate us, which is hard for us to do because they're homeless just like us. But we're trying to organize, and a lot of camps can't organize. The ones in Oakland will not organize.
How are you trying to organize?
Well, we organize by taking polls, basically. Normally, if some needs come in, you know, we take a poll. You know, we have meetings. I think we need to move.
You used to have meetings, and we're not going to have them again?
Meetings like we were every Wednesday, we have a meeting. But we, since our the people that had just moved out of here, we had issues with that, we're actually trying to run this camp.
What were those issues, if you wish to say?
Positions?
Well, you said you had issues with them. There was differences of opinion.
What they did was they were separating themselves from the rest of the camp, and they were controlling the meetings. And you know, one of them did have good connections with the, you know, going to the city council meetings.
Mike Lee.
And well, the ones I'm talking about right now was I don't want to put their names out there right now, but sure. They felt like they were losing control of the camp because people weren't listening to them no more. And just one day, everybody just got up. The whole camp just got up, not them, and just started cleaning and just started saying, you know what, we're going to do what we're going to do. And I think they feel like they lost control and they started rebelling.
What form did this rebellion take?
Painting all the way on the sidewalk in front of the whole camp. Suicide is great. 10 ways to kill yourself. FTP, you know, fuck the police. And I went out there, when I saw that, and I went out there and I told them, this is not how we represent this camp. You know, I've only been here for 4 months, and I'm such a newbie to all this and everything, but I think they felt like they were losing control at that point, because I went out there.
Just two guys, or?
It's a guy and a girl, and the girl's son. But when they see me cleaning the sidewalk, they put up the cameras, started recording me, calling me names, and, you know, F you and all that stuff.
Originally with the camp, who then left?
Yeah, because they weren't accepted here. You know, they put out the rules. When I walked in this camp, they handed me the paper with all the rules. And
they being the people who eventually left.
And once they started breaking the rules by coming in drunk and, you know, doing whatever they do, and destroying the sidewalk out front, they got mad at me. I became the bad guy. They videotaped me putting it on Facebook and started calling me names. And you know, they were ready to go. So we told them they had to go, and they rebelled. Knives came out, and it got really bad. And then they decided on their own a week later that they just better leave. And so they left. And the camp took a deep breath and just kind of changed its format. And
how has it changed?
Well, we don't have mandatory meetings every Wednesday. In those meetings, a lot of people butt heads and started a lot of fights. And the meetings would end early because of that. So they were just, there's too many kings, too many people with what they think their idea is the best way to do it.
Any other changes other than the meeting situation?
Well, we had a like big piece of wood in the tree that we didn't want there that they had put up there. And a lot of organization, like we scaled down a lot of our food due to a rat problem that we've been having. And we got them in boxes, and then the rest of it, we just kind of like minimalized a bit. And just taking care of a lot more of the trash and just like making it more tidy up here, you know, because they were wanting to like have all this stuff out like everywhere, and all these huge signs and like this big store and everything that was causing a lot of extra commotion we didn't need. And so like we just took action upon ourselves to like just take that stuff down so that we could, you know, start looking like the model camp and not.
With the other encampment across on the other side of the railroad tracks that you've talked about, which is, you know, freewheeling and sometimes tries to take credit for being a part of your camp but isn't. Were they around at that time as well?
They did exist at that time, but
about six, ten,
so over there. So.
And they've expanded simply because of the homeless situation, because they become more organized?
Apparently they swept a big camp with 20, 30 people. excuse me, and that's when a lot of people started coming in, and that's when that started building up over there. People started showing up on benches, park benches, and bus benches and stuff like that.
How long ago was the sweep?
That was 3 weeks.
I specifically don't remember this sweep. I didn't hear about it.
Yeah, it was about 3 weeks ago, and that's when this started growing here.
In Santa Cruz, we were having a problem of intra-homeless theft, people stealing from each other a lot. Does that happen much here?
Not in this camp. Not in this camp. We all look out after each other's stuff. You can leave here with your purse, with your radio, with your laptop, and it'll be fine because we don't let people come straggling through. If we don't know somebody, just like he did to you when you come walking up, he came up to you. You know, we watch everybody that comes in this camp, and if they're not, you know, if we don't need them in here, if they're causing a ruckus, we ask them to leave.
If you're anxious about what they're going
to
do.
Yeah. And we try to offer them food, like I said earlier. Offer, you need something to eat, you need something to drink, you know, okay. You can't stay here.
So so nothing has disappeared from the camp that you know of any value in how long a period of time?
Just an example. I left my backpack with my laptop and, like, all the stuff in it on my porch on accident, and it stayed there for around 15 hours, and nobody touched it, nothing even happened to it.
Have you haven't lost any personal property yourself?
I've lost my phone, but I think I just lost it. I just misplaced it somewhere. But
what about you?
I haven't lost anything. There's some people that, you know, since we used to have a store, and we had like it was called the Free Store. It had an umbrella over it, and it had, you know, two tables, and we had all shoes and clothes and food and sodas and everything out there. And at that point, a lot of people were coming by, and then when people would kind of come through here, and it's like somebody lost their light, somebody lost something, like, you know, a phone, a light, the flashlight.
How long ago was
it? Well, the store came down after these people that were apparently running this place left. The store came down right away. In fact, the store was coming down when they were right before they left, like a day before they left, and they were totally against it and just causing the ruckus, but we took it down anyway. That was how we took over this camp. The people are trying to do right and make it look good. The store was bringing in people from the sidewalk, which we wanted them to come in and get free clothes and food and stuff like that, because people are doing that for us. And the things that we don't need, we want to help the other homeless too. I mean, we're fighting for the homeless altogether.
You were saying you're fighting for yourselves as well.
Yeah, we're trying to create this model camp that people keep calling us and show them that we can survive being homeless and we're not an issue to the public right now. And we want to bring other people in and show the public that this can happen, it can work. You know, not everybody's going to, you know, be with us on this, and there's a lot of people that are depressed and on drugs and stuff like that, and they just don't have the motivation to try to fight for their rights, and that's what we're here for. We're fighting for our rights. People drop into this place, and it could happen to anybody. I mean, somebody could go upside down on their house payment, somebody could lose their vehicle and lose their job because of that. There's so many different ways somebody could fall into what we fell into, and that's kind of where our heads are at right now. I mean, there's 5 people in here that work, do jobs every day.
Out of a total of about 25?
Yeah. No, I don't think we're quite at 25, maybe 20, 22, somewhere around there.
And is there a number or an email that people can reach you at if they want more information about the camp? You don't have to give it out if you don't want to, but in case you do, and if you want to give it out to me, and I individually, I can ask for a person's number and then give it to you, and you can decide if you want to contact them.
Welcome back.
First it came for the homeless on the internet. You type that in, or
we don't have anybody at the camp that has that email though.
Yeah, I think the one of the girls that left was, she had something going on Facebook and a lot of responses, and she was really tied into Facebook in this camp, but she's not here anymore. So, as far
we don't have a Facebook page or anything, so
No.
I will try to codge a phone number out of these guys and see if I can.
Type in on the internet, hear their protest camp. That will take you right to all the information, and it'll take you to all the other names this camp was, and, you know, it has a lot of information.
Hear their protest camp.
Yeah, that's how I found this place.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting. But you were here before it was Hear Their Protest Camp.
I came here, yeah, before they... Yeah, about 4 months ago, I believe it, they were still going with the Poor Tour or...
First they came for the homeless.
Yeah, first they came for the homeless.
It was a group that started out to Occupy San Francisco, I think,
yeah.
Way back when.
They had a shirt that had all the different locations that they were, and after each name...
I wanted one of those shirts. I never got one. Yeah, well, 9 months ago when I visited here or some such thing, 8 months ago, something like that. So, anything you guys want to add before I close down?
Well, we've gotten some local support from an animal rights group called Direct Action Everywhere Squad, and basically they've sent they're preparing emails to send to city council, basically saying that if anything happens to our camp, like the police come through and try to take all of our stuff basically and shut us down, that, you know, there's going to be protests against the city and against the police station, you know, stating that, you know, this is a means of survival for people that, you know, either can't survive capitalism or don't want to contribute to capitalism. So
anything else you want to add?
I think we're going in the right direction, and like he said, you know, he's got is a personal supporter, which he got for us, which is your company that you do volunteer work for. There is still some anarchists in here. I have no problem with anarchists. I'm not an anarchist myself. I'm not going to go out there and just say, you know, fuck the police and get out of my face. And I'm not going to push the issue. I know. This is my personal thing. But I believe in anarchy because it brought us here. It made the officers listen. It made the state listen. And so I have no problem with that. But I think where our goal is in this camp is to stop fucking with everybody and leave us the heck alone. You know what I mean? And they're leaving us alone right now, and we're cleaning the whole camp area. And, you know, within this block right now, we keep clean every morning. You know, we empty our trash, so we're trying to be a model. And I think we're following through with that.
And we've been talking with
Jay DeMello,
as well as
Robin Housley.
Thank you both.
Welcome back. I'm joined by my guest, Presidential Advisor Kellyanne Conway. Kellyanne, great to have you. I haven't seen you in a while. But then again, I haven't stood in my bathroom with the lights off and said your name 3 times into my mirror. Casey, let's talk about the future of DACA, which for those viewers who are not familiar stands for Donald's a Cold-Hearted Ass Face.
Well, a few things on DACA. The Congress had all year to act. A legislative fix or some clarity would be helpful.
If the president decides to end the policy, it could potentially sabotage the futures of many hardworking dreamers, as well as deport close to 1 million undocumented immigrants, not to mention the devastating toll it would take on my sex life.
The president has expressed sympathy for many of the so-called dreamers, but they refer to themselves as dreamers.
Kellyanne, I'm sorry to interrupt, but we are about to go to a live feed from inside the hollow tree where Jeff Sessions makes the cookies. Let's see what she has to say.
Good morning. I'm here today to announce that the program known as DACA that was effectuated under the Obama administration is being rescinded.
And there you have it. Kellyanne, when Donald Trump was elected, he said that he had a big heart and that anyone vulnerable to a change of this nature should rest easy. What the hell happened to that crap?
Well, that's what leaders do, though. Leaders listen to many different insights and inputs and contrasting opinions. The president surrounds himself with people of that nature. But at the same time, I want to remind you, he has never backed down from the fact that this is a country, it's a nation.
Dark shame, Donald. Dark shame. Thank you for all the stress and strain. Can't you be half as generous as you've been with the KKK and white supremacists?
dark as shame, put him on a plane back to from whence they never came. How the f*** can you sleep at night knowing like you do nothing to you do is right? Darker shame, a darker shame. Hey, how you doing? Go yourself, darling. Darker shame, you for causing so much pain. Just behold all the lies you told and this anarchy caused by your cowardly darker shame. Darker shame, you've got a little bit of darker shame. And hey girl, you should feel the same. Shut your face, you're a big disgrace. Stop your slandering, pandering to your face. Darker shame, darker shame, you're dark again. You all, oh, you're all to blame. This guy, also this day. And what's his name? Darker shame, darker shame, darker shame, darker shame, darling, you're insane. Darker shame, darker shame.
I do have a big heart.
Go back to Queens.
Welcome back. Joining me in this segment, Donald Trump's newly appointed communications director, formerly a very vocal adversary of Mr. Trump, Anthony Scaramucci, a.k.a. Scar, a.k.a. the Mooch, a.k.a. this f***ing guy. Anthony, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for letting me be here. Thank you.
Your recent appointment by the president has many people questioning where you suddenly came from, but the truth is that you have been in the public spotlight for some time as a well-known Wall Street financier, an entrepreneur, and most notably, as Charlotte's gay wedding planner on Sex and the City.
No, hold on a second,
Anthony, a lot has happened in the short time you've been in office. Sean Spicer resigned, Reince Priebus has been replaced. An interview you gave to The New Yorker went viral in which you referred to Mr. Priebus as a f***ing paranoid schizophrenic and disparaged Steve Bannon by saying, quote, I'm not Steve Bannon, I'm not here to suck my own f***. Now, Anthony, is that kind of language really f***ing appropriate?
Well, okay, so let's talk about that, okay? If you take the psychological equation...
Okay, I'm bored. Let's move to health care and yet another embarrassing loss suffered by the Republicans.
What the president is trying to do is make the health care system freer. However, because it's Washington and there's a lot of webs here in Washington that have to be broken up like the cobwebs in your ass, we have to get out there and start with incrementalism. The president has a very unique communication style. I would argue, people will say that I'm being sycophantic. I'm not. I'm just being objective. He is arguably the most media savvy person in history. But certainly
I love his fancy ties, his little beady eyes, the crap he talks about Steve Bannon and Reince Priebus. The way he handles Sean, the way he carries on about the stuff that he won't do with his own peanuts. And yeah, I know he's kind of fine, but he hasn't got a spine. He just erases everything he's ever said. I know he once was all resist. Now he's happy to assist because he'll do anything to get ahead. I get so horny when he blows a smooch. He is the essence of a bag of douche. And no one's head was further up Trump's ass than Donald Trump's until the mooch.
Cause he's a sycophant Italiano.
Yes, he's a sycophant Italiano. What's the deal with sycophant Italiano? It's all a spiel with sycophant Italiano. And nothing's real with sycophant Italiano.
You will never hear me say, hey, go on so-and-so. I want it.
Well, that's because you're classy.
His Harvard Law degree and his vulgarity make little macho scaramucci mucho scary. The way his diction pops, consistent malaprops. Could someone get this friggin' guy a dictionary? I love his vacillating views. His press interviews are all colorful and crazy. Like an audition for Martin Scorsese.
Scaramouche, Scaramouche, he's all up on that man.
There, I did it. Now stop emailing me.
And so we're practicing political entrepreneurialism of incrementalism. Let's get this done right now.
Excuse me for interrupting, Anthony, but we have some breaking news. It appears that after only 10 days, the president has fired you as communications director.
Well, okay, so let's talk about that.
He was the sycophant
that was quick.
And now his job is done.
Arrivederci. And that's more from Randy Rainbow's pretty funny stuff on YouTube. Check it out. Just browse for Randy Rainbow. So uncharacteristically, I'm going to kind of end this show early because I'm up against a deadline. And if you've enjoyed it, that's good. If you think stuff has been left out that should be in terms of homeless civil rights activity, which we haven't had too much in the way of news updates, that may be good in terms of people being busted and encampments being driven away. I mean, there was a report yesterday of people being hosed. Well, I was going to say hosed off the sidewalk near the post office, but all that happened was there was another massive steam cleaning of the sidewalk reported by an activist who happened by the Huff meeting. I haven't heard whether folks have been further harassed. I think I might well have. If you want to stay up on this, check out the Food Not Bombs, Santa Cruz Food Not Bombs Facebook page, or the Freedom Sleepers page. Freedom Sleepers is a group that was in front of City Hall, but actually now, through their, well, not so much the Freedom Sleepers, but the Survival Sleepers that sort of took up the task of the Freedom Sleepers and did it every night at City Hall, has moved to the post office and is there. And I'm predicting they'll be there, that they won't be there after the Association of Faith Communities Winter Shelter Program opens. I'm thinking it's going to open in November, but who knows? It might open earlier. For about 100 people, maybe a few more. Again, less than 10% of the on-the-street population of Santa Cruz. I should say on the streets and abouts, in the parks and down the way, and maybe on some sofas sometimes and so forth. Anyway, I will be coming back at you, hopefully with a longer show on Sunday, but it's likely to be a flashback. I'm finding, again, energy problems with doing the show, and so I'm not going to make any promises I can't keep. So tune in if you're interested. Call in if you have reports, 423-4833, or questions, or if you have any suggestions on a location for Free Radio Studio 10x10 space. And that's what we're looking for with electricity, internet, and access to a bathroom. $500 reward, yeah. No change with that one yet. And or if you have any questions about Free Radio, you can also go to the Free Radio website at freakradio.org. For more information on Huff, go to huffsantacruz.org or give me a call on the Huff line at 423-HUFF. Thanks.
Nobody thunk it. Nobody knew.
Hi, this is Coral Reed. Fill it in for the not a one and only.
Cows are one.
Uncle Dennis.
He hid in the forest, read books with great zeal. He loved Che Guevara, a revolutionary.
I couldn't find the theme song for Dennis, but it'll be coming up. And tonight, I'll be playing music from the 60s, 70s, a little bit of the 80s. Hope you enjoy it.
Cow doll drums. He moved, we must fight, escape or we'll die. Cows gathered around, cause the stakes were so high.
Free Radio Santa Cruz!
Free radio.
Music should be free, and so should radio. This is Ian from Fugazi.
This is Jello Biafra.
Radio.
Radioactive.
This is Boots Riley from the Coup.
Hey, this is Emily from the Indigo Girls.
Hello there, this is Tom Morello.
Peace be still, this is Azeem checking in from Oakland, California.
This is Jim Page.
Yo, what the deal? This is Immortal Technique.
This is so-and-so from 15.
This is Michelle Shuck.
This is Mike Park.
This is Thomas from Striking New Air.
And whenever I'm running from the police, I gotta find out where to go. I listen to Free Radio Santa Cruz.
101.1
Freak Radio.
Freak, freak, freak radio.
On your FM dial has been successfully flying the skull and crossbones for the past 10 years.
Amen! FM Hallelujah!
Freak Radio Santa Cruz is a vital part of this country's independent media.
Santa Cruz 101.1 FM. Live stream online at www.freakradio.org.
Music should be free. So should radio.
You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 and www.freakradio.org. Remember to tune in from the cream to the dregs with Uncle Dennis every Thursday night at 8 o'clock. Music from the 60s and the 70s brought to you on Free Radio Santa Cruz and nowhere else.
By Dixie Drakes here on 101.3 FM.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. So
fast. Move along, come inside, the show's about to start. Guaranteed to blow your head apart. Rest assured, you'll get your money's worth. Greatest show in heaven, hell, and you gotta see the show. It's a dynamo, you gotta see the show. It's rock and roll. Right before your eyes, we pull laughter from the sky. Happens and it cries, and dies and it dies. Come inside, show's about to start. Guaranteed to blow your head apart. You gotta see the show. It's a dynamo. You gotta see the show. It's rock and roll.